You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Hello, comrades. This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm so excited to be here with you today, and my special host today is returning for the second day in a row, Mr. Tony Hovater. Tony Hovater, how you doing?
Pretty good. I said we should do it again soon, so I guess the next day works out.
That is as soon as I could get it. Now, the reason you're back, not only do I love your conversation, but a good point was brought up by Sven when we were talking earlier that, you know, due to the fact that, you know, due to work and my, you know, the birth of my son, we haven't really been able to podcast and keep people appraised about what's been going on since really back to the Pikeville event. And by golly, have things changed from there. So as someone who's been on the front lines, whether it was at Auburn all the way to Charlottesville, the work you do in your communities, you're the guy to talk to. So I want you to start out a broad sketch as to where you think that the movement, where we've come since Pikeville. Let's zoom back a little bit farther, because I think this is like one long thread. Like Auburn to now, where have we gone? Where are we going?
We've gone from just Richard Spencer speaking at a college in a little tiny protest to full-on rioting in the streets, National Guard being called in. So I'd say things have moved right along. But I don't know. We seem to be in a pretty good place, honestly. A lot of people were fairly black-pilled post-Charlottesville, as if, you know, they didn't think that the media and the establishment were going to push back at us having a large gathering. But it seems like all that's kind of died down. And despite all the censorship and stuff, it seems like people are actually very willing to keep moving forward, and people even want to do more public events.
Well, let's talk about something real quick. The fact that in Charlottesville, of course, you know, largest demonstration in a generation here in the United States, it was incredibly impressive. The Nationalist Front groups with TWP, the League of the South, and our other friends and allies, we had over 300 people in our column alone marching. I mean, down the street, like when we were at the bottom of the hill, you couldn't see the end of our column as it was still coming out of the parking garage. And that was just part of the people that were in attendance at Unite the Right. I mean, this was an incredibly impressive event. You know, I've been to Greece, I've been to Germany, I've been to the Czech Republic, I've been to Romania, I've gone to nationalist demonstrations. Charlottesville felt in many ways like a European style nationalist event. Now, one thing is, one dude showed up with a swastika flag. Now, of course, I'm a national socialist. I have no problem with the swastika as a symbol, especially honoring NSDAP Germany and the inspirations that we get from them. But it's not our symbol, right? You know, the idea that, you know, even in the 1920s and 30s, the Rexist Party in Belgium had their own symbol. The Iron Guard had their own symbol. The Falangists had their own symbol. It's not cucking on ideology when you just develop your own symbolism for your own national socialist movement in your country, right? Even during the time when Adolf Hitler was still alive and breathing, all the different countries, their different movements and different symbols that spoke to their people while still working together. But one guy brought a swastika flag, and I saw so much stuff, not from our side, but different internet commenters, the guys that have never left behind a keyboard, saying like, oh, that ruined the optics that a dude had a swastika flag. And Tony, at what point do the Jew media, do they go, oh, your optics are so good. These are just a bunch of nice boys that care about their country. I didn't think that ever happened, but the internet seems to think so. I want your take on optics in regards to that situation, but kind of optics in general, stemming from Charlottesville.
Okay, I mean that's kind of a broad thing, and there's a lot to that. Like, obviously, like, optics are important to a degree, you know, just in your daily life. If you're trying to make a point with somebody, there's two routes you can go. You can be screaming and yelling and being aggressive, or making a nice point. Like, I get that, you know, that is important. We don't want to show up, you know, you know, and like all wearing like Dale Earnhardt shirts or something very bizarre, because then that would be bizarre optics. We wouldn't be making any point. But the thing with like the swastika flag guy, like we have an event with thousands of people, all from like different organizations that didn't have the best of communication right before. How do we police that? How do we police every single person? You know, it's a flag. I don't know. A lot of people
that I think is really interesting is the guy, from what I saw, was a lone wolf. He was just a guy that was there by himself. Yeah. I mean, if you saw that, you know, when it came to the organizations, this is why it's important, y'all, in my opinion, to have actual groups to be a part of, because it allows for a standardization. It allows for everyone being on the same page. It allows for increased professionalism, because, you know, the guy with the swastika flag wasn't a member of TWP, the League of the South, the National Socialist Movement, who, like, historically, they did use the swastika flag, but, you know, they've developed a unique symbol for them now. They even had a Roman standard, which I thought was really freaking cool, actually, when it comes to optics.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was just a random guy, and we cannot get ourselves all bent out of shape over, like, a random dude that isn't exactly on point, because the media will always find, even if we've got the most polished spokesman, we've got the best people, they will go, they will look for a member that, you know, if they can, that maybe isn't, you know, isn't exactly a public speaker, and then try and cut things up and mock them. They will find someone randomly on the internet who has never been a member of our organizations, but has an opinion, and then, you know, they could be totally unaffiliated with Charlottesville, for instance, but they found one random, like, internet commenter that said something outrageous. Well, they'll go with that and say, like, the official position of the Unite the Right event. Like, we need to understand how the Jewish media works, and they don't care about truth. And, I mean, if you just look, like, the Torchlight Parade, for instance, or the polo shirts, you go from being Klansmen and Nazis. I mean, David Duke had to deal with the same thing, to closet Nazis and Klansmen, to suit and tie Nazis and Klansmen, to, I mean, Jared Taylor, who doesn't touch the JQ, who, you know, has his own unique thing, who talks, has statistics out the wazoo for all of his positions, that has no relation whatsoever to the ideology of National Socialism, he's still a suit and tie Nazi. At no point in time, if you are challenging the Jewish system at all, do you become a suit, do not become a Nazi. Like, you're always Nazi or Klan, regardless of what you do. Now, that doesn't mean that we fall into stereotypes when we're presenting ourselves to the public, but this search for not being called names by the media is never going to happen. They're always going to call you a Nazi or a Klansman or a white supremacist or a hate group because you're challenging the Jewish control over our system.
It's goofy. And back to, like, how people perceive it. Like, I get that, you know, every group wants to be taken seriously. Like, they don't want to have their message misconstrued. I get that. But, you know, like, after we got kicked out of the park, and I don't know if I've talked to you personally about this or not, because at this point, I think you're further behind me in the column. There were, like, boomers, like, coming out of their house and, like, walking up to us, and I thought they were going to, like, start some shit, you know. But, no, they, like, walked up to, like, shake my hand to be like, hey, you boys are doing the right thing. And, you know, I've got these creepy pointed eyebrows. You know, I'm wearing all black. I've got an armband on. And a normie is like, hey, thank you. Like, you're standing up for something that I believe in. So optics, while important, I think they overstress it. The boat shoes and the polos, like, it might not be the end-all be-all when it comes to optics.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, as we were talking about yesterday, this mass shooting, for instance, if it does turn out that this guy was a radical leftist, now it could turn out the dude racked up $200,000 worth of casino debt, and, you know, he wasn't going to pay that debt. You know, he swore it was going to be number 18 black, and it wasn't, you know, and people just do crazy stuff. But if it does turn out, as some of the evidence suggests, that, you know, it's looking like he might have been an anti-Trumper and stuff like that. And again, I mean, even Breitbart is writing about, you know, an attack on a country music concert is really an attack on, like, implicit, like, traditional America, which, of course, means white. You know, if it does turn out to be that, you know, normal people are seeing, whether it's that church shooting, whether it's the BLM blocking roads as you're just trying to get to work. I mean, you know, or the leftists that are rioting, whether it's the election and inauguration of Donald Trump to a police officer with a jury of his peers, including non-white members of a jury, find him not guilty of defending himself against, you know, a thug of some ethnic background, then the streets go up in flames. At the end of the day, as all this crazy stuff is happening, the average person, because the average person, like when they're blocking roads and stuff, he just wants to get to work. He wants to do his job. He wants to come home. He wants to take his son to Little League. He wants to kiss his wife, have dinner with his family, read his little girl a book, go to bed, and then get up and do it all over again. He just wants to take care of his family. That's a normal human, you know, instinct. And these radical leftists, which everything from the LGBT to the Saudi-backed Wahhabis to Black Lives Matter to college communists, want to destroy that. I want to rub that guy's face in you know, self-loathing, basically, and are threatening even to, like, kill his family. So at the end of the day, like, that guy is going to look, and that woman who wants to take care of her children are going to be looking towards people that can provide stability, security, and defense. I mean, not that everything relates back to NS Germany. Like, you know, we call them, but not everything it can instantly be translated, right? Different historical context, different political situation, different economic situation. But what pushed the NSDAP over the edge to be able to run the country, it wasn't, you know, the fanatics, and I say that in a good way, of the SA and stuff like that. They held the line for years. They lost thousands of members in fights with the communists. But the Reds kept riding. They kept threatening to destroy everything. And that's when the middle class doesn't come on board early on. You know, the people that we can appeal to are polo shirts and stuff like that. It's when they feel that their livelihood is actively threatened by the left. That's when they look for stability. The industrialists said, you know, if these communists win, well, they're going to take everything. They're going to shoot me and my family. They're going to take everything. And then Germany is going to be the western border of the Soviet Union. Like, they weren't ideological national socialists, many of them, but they realized that national socialism can be a bulwark against radical leftism. And yeah, you are going to have to pay more of your fair share. Yeah, you're going to have to treat your workers better. Yeah, there's a new sheriff in town, but you're not going to get lined up against a wall and shot for having, like, a piece of property. You know, when there's instability, people crave stability. And that's what we need to present. We need to present strength and stability. And the Republicans sure as heck aren't going to do that. They fall over themselves to promote instability. And we need to be, you know, not looking to appeal to the masses insofar as looking just like them. We need to stand out from them to show and then be very professional, do charity work, do all this stuff, but show them that we are stability for their families and their communities.
Yeah, no, that's all people care about. You know, they care about their families, their friends, like their towns. Like, nobody's ever, you know, stood up and made an ideology out of, like, economic progress. You know, like, nobody cares about what the Chamber of Commerce has to say. You know, you can buy some, you know, cheap raincoats and, like, you know, lead infused toys from China for a little bit less. Like, that's not something that people are going to, you know, stand up and fight for. But, like, their family and their future absolutely is. So you're absolutely right.
You know, well, you know, our profits will go up by 0.2% this year. So that means we obviously need how many more Mexicans, Bill? Two million. We need 2 million more Mexicans. Like, go and crash their economy a little bit more and then bring them over here. You know, I mean, this is where we need to stand for our people. And that's how groups like Golden Dawn have become so successful, because they've been able to, you know, they were a very small group for decades, but they never wavered on their ideology. They were always providing community service. And then during 2008, there was economic instability. Things were falling apart, and they were there. That's how they're able to win. You know, I talked to my Golden Dawn buddies. There were right-wing parties, hardcore right-wing parties, nationalist parties, that have come and gone over the period of Golden Dawn. They said, like, half a dozen at least. Because if you're not built on a foundation where you're not going to pivot for temporary political gain or acceptance, but instead you're just standing on truth, it might not get you the instant results that you want. You're not going to fit that instant gratification, but people know that they can trust you. If there's one thing people hate, it's a used car salesman, you know, or the Baptist preacher that's putting the plate around for the fifth time in the service. Just stand by the truth and stand by your values, and then people will realize when the moment comes, they can trust us. And trust is something that you cannot buy. It's not something that you can get a polished image and people will trust you. You've got to build trust with communities. And that's what we're investing in now, because this struggle is not going to be over in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, probably. This is a long-term, multi-generational thing, and it's got to be built on solid ideology and trust. And trust is how we need to be able to win over our communities. Because at the end of the day, if they like us, You know, if we just look at any sort of nationalist movement, if the people like you, if they know, you know, whether it was in Chicago or New York or stuff like that, or Boston, you know, if you lived in an Irish neighborhood or an Italian neighborhood, you know, you sided more with the mob than you did with the cops, because the cops didn't care about you. The city didn't care about you. But, you know, the institutions that were in your own community, they made sure that everything ran smoothly, that there wasn't crime on your streets, that, you know, that everyone had a Christmas turkey, that everyone was taken care of. And, you know, that's building real trust, kind of a state within a state. Now, I'm not suggesting that we act like the mob, of course, but you understand what I'm saying. And in regard to building community trust, and that gets their loyalty away from the institutionalized powers that are really the problem that we're facing.
Yeah, absolutely. The only way we're going to win is with Christmas turkeys for every family.
I like that. So, you know, I was thinking about something too, about helping our people. And I was watching yesterday a documentary on police, basically in Appalachia. And it was interesting. They remarked that over 90% of their of the crime in the county was drug or alcohol related. And it was actually just really, really depressing. I mean, there was like two black guys the entire jail that I saw, and they were, you know, not gangbanger types. And it was just sad to see people who had their families, you know, they talk about their kids they have on the outside, and they'd fallen in. And every single story started the same way, that people had been prescribed drugs, always opioids, and then they'd fallen into addiction, whether it was knocking over a guy knocked over a pharmacy to try and get more pills after his prescription had been cut off, or a mom that, you know, just ended up breaking her ankle and ended up getting hooked on pills. You know, the majority of our people who are falling into things like drug addiction, it's not that they just like decide one day they wake up and they're like, I want to shoot heroin. It's actually coming from the doctors. And this is a plague that's upon our communities that no one's really talking about. So as our movement's kind of pushing forward, as we're really discovering ourselves and seeing the issues, the opioid epidemic is an issue that no one is touching. Now, I want to just touch briefly, because, of course, you live in the Midwest, you know, in the Rust Belt. Can you talk about the opioid epidemic and the drug problems you see in your communities, and why people are falling into this?
Yeah, actually, the county right next to mine, like the actual county that Dayton is in, it has the it's the number one county of per capita deaths related to opioids in the entire country. And even like this small town that I live in here, which is a, you know, quaint little place, there's really not like crime here. The only crime is like drug busts having to do with like, you know, what is it, fentanyl and like heroin and all that. But a lot of it does stem from people that like veterans come back, they're prescribed this. People overprescribe it for even like minor pains, like small surgeries even. And, you know, this was something we talked about the other day. You know, doctors said this stuff isn't addictive. Well, what do you know? Like, people are willing to literally attack each other for it. So this is actually this is like top down. This is a bigger issue than just, oh, the drugs are too widely available. But it seems that there's sort of I don't want to say it's like a conscious effort to get people hooked on it, but it seems like there was a conscious effort to lie about the long term effects.
Well, it's one of those moments as you're looking at what the white working class is facing, over 100 deaths a day due to the opioid epidemic. And then you hear black folks talk about Ronald Reagan created crack. And I'm kind of sitting here like, I don't know, maybe Ronald Reagan did create crack. You know, like,
it was Nancy. You know, that's the final red pill.
Well, I mean, it really is like the sort of thing that you think about. You've got kids guarding opium fields in Afghanistan. That opium is then cut and sold. It'll go to China or Mexico, you know, and then it'll end up as street heroin. So that veteran gets injured, as you said, comes home. The VA prescribes him medicine that is actually kind of derived from the opium he was defending. He ends up, you know, getting addicted. He gets cut off. There is no actual treatment to be able to get people off of the you know, substances they were addicted to. Then he ends up buying heroin that he actually, you know, helped tend basically in Afghanistan, gets busted for it, gets sent to a for-private prison where then he's used as slave labor for a multinational corporation that is absolutely bought off the politicians. I mean, this is a fundamental conspiracy. And I don't mean that in like the tinfoil hat way. I just mean there is a tremendous amount of money being won. And, you know, the rise of the opioid epidemic, the rise of the access to easy heroin and stuff like that, really, I mean, it's always existed, you know, in the past couple generations. But ever since Afghanistan has been allowed to basically be like the drug dealer of the world under the protection of the guns of the U.S. military, we see this problem everywhere. I mean, I was talking to our buddies in Russia, from Russia, from the Russian Imperial Movement. They're over here visiting. They said their towns are absolutely full up of heroin and things like that. And it comes from China, and it comes from originally Afghanistan, that this is an American worldwide plot. And yeah, you know, whether they're just trying to kill us or whatever, I mean, maybe. But at the very least, it's just absolute profits over people, that there are billions of dollars to be made when you decide that you want to get everyone hooked and addicted to your drugs. And then you can use them on the back end as slave labor in private prisons and things like that. I mean, they're really double dipping and destroying hundreds of thousands of families every single year. I mean, 100 people a day. In the span of this show, another white working class person here in America is going to die, not just overdose, but die of their addiction to opioids. And no one's doing anything about it. And Donald Trump said he was going to do something about it, and he's not. I mean, do you see any chance the Republicans get their heads out of their butts and actually help the people they promised to help? Because this, you know, fiscal conservatism, there's always money to buy another cruise missile, not enough money to open a treatment clinic to get people off of drugs or to get them job training. I see us as really the only ones that are speaking up about this issue. What do you think?
Of course we're the only ones to speak up about the issue. A lot of people look at like the drug epidemic as like kind of, I don't think they like consciously do this, but they see it as like a class thing. They see people that they deem like below them as the people struggling with this. But that's not even factually how it is. Like, this is like something that's affecting like suburban moms now. No, and it's really sad to see that it is like such a cycle. You know, you think you're doing the right thing. A lot of young boys join like the military. They want to, you know, protect freedom and, you know, help their country and all that. But then they're just literally sold down the river and they go to jail for doing drugs that they helped make. You know, it's stunning.
Yeah, while talking about that, we support the troops, you know, like the Republicans, I mean, the Democrats too, everyone supports the troops, but not when it comes to actually helping them. And I mean, that's even double so. I mean, at least there's a VA, but you look at the Republican health care plan. Oh my God, what they're putting forward with trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Now, I'm not going to say the Affordable Care Act fixed the problems of the American healthcare industry. Of course it didn't. But at the same time, the fact that it would absolutely, removing the ACA would absolutely gut healthcare access in rural white working class areas. And it just seems like common sense to me. If the Republicans actually cared about winning, you should at least consider, like, I don't know, not killing off your base. I mean, demographics are already changing. It's probably not a wise just, you know, strategy to kill off your entire base, but they seem to want nothing more, whether it's mountaintop removal that ends up, you know, displacing people and poisoning entire communities' water supplies, to removing healthcare to be able to feed the military industrial complex, to not addressing the opioid epidemic and actually profiting off of it. It seems like the Republicans are doing everything they can to displace and actually kill our people, the people that actually vote for them. I mean, the idea, as our party grows and we're able to build more infrastructure, that you know, white folks would still vote for the Republican Party in 5 years, 10 years, is absolute lunacy to me, because the Republicans are doing everything they can to utterly screw these people and try and kill them and break apart their families.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's not as though Democrats are going to be loving white people anytime soon. But one example of how much the Republicans absolutely do not care about their base. They were LARPing and screaming about the ACA for years, 7 years. OK, you know, we're going to repeal it. We're going to replace it. We got a plan, you know. They come up to bat. Absolutely not. They haven't done shit. But as soon as Trump announces something about DACA, the very next day they went in and had a bipartisan bill, the Bridge Act, you know, to start helping to extend their little period of time where they can actually stay here or whatever. So clearly they don't care about white people. Clearly, they don't care about us at all, and we're the only ones that are going to be there for them. So, you know, I posted about this the other day. It's like, you guys or the corporations can actually try to help these people, or we're going to be there to fill a market demand, you know? Like, we're going to be there to help.
I mean, how does someone not come up with a plan in 7 years? It just seems like at some point you would have sat down and actually wrote something down. But I think it's kind of a testament of the Republican Party. The Republican Party makes no sense as an actual legitimate political party? Like, what is the agenda of the GOP? It's I don't know. They're not Democrats. Like, that's it. You've got the you know, you've got the business side that absolutely doesn't care about traditional values, doesn't care about immigration. They actually want more immigration to be able to feed their need for cheap labor. And then you've got the evangelicals, you've got the gun people, you've got, I mean, all these different groups. It absolutely doesn't make sense. They can't pass a bill. They have the Supreme Court, the presidency, the House, and the Senate, and they can't pass a single thing except a condemnation of white nationalists after Charlottesville. It's the only thing they've been able to pass. They cannot do anything because they're a party that is dying. And it's not just that they don't have enough votes. They don't even have a vision. They don't even have basic things they can agree on. They can be in opposition to the Democrats. But, you know, the business interests will not side with the things that are actually good for the rural white working base. They're ultimately at odds with one another in many ways, as much or even more in some cases than like our people are against the Democrats. I mean, because both sides will want more open borders. Both sides support globalization. At least the Democrats will give you health care. You know, it's not good health care, but at least they'll give you health care. You know, I mean, this is the sort of thing that the right in America, the nationalists in America, we are going to be the only voice that stands up for our people. And the GOP is falling over themselves. I mean, their condemnation, let's close out with that. Their condemnation post-Charlottesville of white nationalism, as white people are becoming a minority in this country, as we're facing more discrimination in hiring and college applications and every element of the society, as we're mocked in the media, as white racial consciousness is growing, the GOP, to a man, voted against not just white supremacy or neo-Nazis or whatever buzzwords, but white nationalism, the idea that white people can advocate as an ethnic group for their best interests. I mean, they have ultimately shot themselves in the foot. Even just 5 or 10 years from now, they're going to absolutely have discredited themselves with their base. And that leaves a huge market for us to be able to go in and advocate for our people and to win their loyalty.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what they think they're doing. They're not even making short-term gains. And also, like, they don't even need to, because as you said, they have like every branch of government right now. They could pass whatever goofy bill they want. So there's nothing to this aside from virtue signaling, because they think the country's shifting leftward.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything's about virtue signaling. Everything in America, like the idea, I mean, you've got Democrats post-shooting that are saying like, oh, you know, we need to stop you know, future terrorist attacks. So we need to ban guns. Well, I was just seeing in Britain, you know, they were going ahead and doing, you know, making it illegal to order a kitchen knife online. Like you can't order a bread knife online anymore because they've got so many knife stabbings. Like, no, okay, fine. You know, look at what ISIS has been doing. All right, ban guns. Are you going to ban trucks? Because if you're not going to ban trucks, terrorists can still use trucks. They can still use knives. They can still throw acid in the faces of American tourists over in, forget if that was in England or I think it was in France.
That was, you know, that was like Paris, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, they will absolutely find a way. The problem is a spiritual problem. The problem is a racial problem. It's a national problem. I mean, you know, 6% of the American population commits over 50% of the murders. If we want to stop this, why don't we ban them? Like, I mean, if you like actually care about reducing crime, then all right, let's ethnostate now and Balkanize. And then just by having 6% of our population no longer in the American crime statistics, we will cut the murder rate in 1 year by half. But they won't do that because they don't care about facts. They just care about virtue signaling.
Yeah, that's really bizarre. But that's actually a point that I've made to a lot of people. And this is something I think Cantwell wrote about years ago, that it makes more sense, statistically speaking, to just be like an out and out, you know, racist and say black dudes cannot buy guns instead of trying to pass all this bizarre legislation. Oh, we need smaller magazines. We can't have this type of ammo. None of that makes sense. They're not the ones doing the crime.
Yeah, I mean, again, like Appalachia, poorest part of America, lowest crime rate. And all the crime, as we mentioned earlier, some 80 to 90% is nonviolent drug crime or like petty theft. That's drug related. Not exactly a crime wave epidemic that we're seeing over close to 1,000 murders a year in Chicago. I mean, this is what our people are facing, and we really need to understand and speak to our people in a blunt and honest way and provide real solutions. That's what our people need. They need real solutions, pragmatic, real solutions to how they and their children can live safer, live better, be healthier, and have a more moral society. That's what it all comes down to. It comes down to actually being able to provide real solutions to our people when it comes to the economy, when it comes to the social situation, when it comes to the view of the nation in general. We need real solutions, and that's what TWP presents. So that's why I think we're going to win. Now we're coming to the end. Tony, give me your final thought for the day.
Everybody, just, you know, ignore the ridiculous optics posters. Get out there and talk to your friends and family and neighbors about actual important issues. It's totally fine, and they will listen.
Amen. All right. Well, Tony Hovater, thank you so much for joining me today. And everyone, thank you so much. I got so many great messages about being back. I'm going to look forward to being here tomorrow. Sven's going to be my co-host, and we're going to have a great show. So everyone, have a great rest of your day, and hail victory.
You've been listening to The Daily Traditionalist on Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.